Today is January the 31st, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of this program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN-FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are slightly different. Based on the correspondence we receive, we find that there are many people listening to the show on demand or podcast than the regular program that is on the air on radio, so we will try to do something different. If you have a technical question or statement you want to make, send us a brief description of what you want to talk about along with your name, telephone number, and the day and time of the day we can call you, and we would then in turn play back telephone recordings of general interest for airing on the Personal Computer Show. In the news during the past week, Fujifilm recalls camera male wall plug power adapters affecting over 300,000 cameras. Wearable devices are tracking military personnel. Apple slashes iPhone X production. The New York Times has an opinion piece that Apple's cooperating with information for the Chinese government. Fujifilm takes over Xerox. A satellite lost in space has been found. DDR memory prices, they haven't come down. Smartphones and the generation now called iGens. Windows 10 future updates. Well, let's get to the news. Manufacturers of electronic equipment, they all share one common fault. And that's the fact that they are using a third-party power adapter or cord that is a no-name product and, you know, they're cheap to manufacture, they buy it in quantities, and unfortunately there's no check on them. Fujifilm has announced that their cameras that were purchased from June 2016 onward, which includes the Fujifilm XP90, XP95, XP120, XP125, X83, and the XA10, the wall plug that shipped with those units might be at risk of cracking and breaking, exposing live electrical contacts and posing a shock hazard. And this covers 300,000 cameras that were purchased during that period of time. The specific power adapter at risk is the AC-5VF, according to Fujifilm. It was shipped with those cameras, sold from that period on, and Fujifilm is recalling about 270,000 of these power adapters in the United States and another 24,000 in Canada. And as with most recalls of this type, not all cameras were affected. However, you really need to check your serial number and get in touch with Fujifilm on it. Take that serial number, go to the Fujifilm site. They'll navigate you to where you can find out whether or not you've been affected, or you can call a toll-free number, 1-833-613-1200. If your camera doesn't come up in the search tool, well, you're safe. If it does, you know what to do. Contact Fujifilm. Unintentional consequences when the military and the consumer market, well, they overlap each other. Sensitive information about the location and staffing of military bases and spy outposts around the world has been revealed by a fitness tracking company. The details were released by Strava and a data visualization map that shows all the activity tracked by users of its app, which allows users to record the exercise and share it with others. The map, released in November of last year, shows every single activity ever uploaded to Strava, more than 3 trillion individual GPS data points. The app can be used on various devices, including smartphones and fitness trackers like Fitbit, to see popular running routes in major cities or spot individuals in more remote areas who have unusual exercise patterns. However, over the weekend, military analysts noticed that the map is also, well, it's quite detailed enough that it potentially gives away extremely sensitive information about a subset of Strava users who are military personnel on active service. U.S. bases are clearly identifiable and mappable. If soldiers use the app like normal people do by turning it on, tracking when they go to do exercise, it could be especially dangerous. A lot of people are going to have to sit through lectures come Monday morning. Zooming in on one of the larger bases clearly reveals its internal layout as mapped out by the track jogging routes of numerous soldiers. The base itself is not visible on the satellite views of commercial providers such as Google Maps or Apple Maps, yet it could be clearly seen through Strava. Potentially sensitive information can still be gleaned. For instance, a map of the Hommy Airport in Nevada, the U.S. Air Force base commonly known as Area 51, records a lone cyclist taking a ride from the base along the west edge of Groom Lake, marked on the heat map by a thin red line. When Strava released the heat map, an updated version of one it had previously published in 2015, that this update includes 6 times more data than before. In total, 1 billion activities from all Strava data through September 2017. Their global heat map is the largest, richest, and most beautiful data set of all kind. It is a direct visualization of Strava global network of athletes. Apple is slashing planned production of the iPhone X or the iPhone X for the 3-month period ending in March due to a weaker than expected demand for, well, let's call this a very pricey handset. Apple plans to make about 20 million iPhone X handsets in the first quarter, down from the original estimate of 40 million units. Apple has also cut orders for components used in the iPhone X by 60%, so they anticipate even less selling at a future point. They always do this when things aren't selling well. The iPhone X was launched on the 10th anniversary of the Apple iPhone. The iPhone X was promoted as a smartphone of the future with features including a sharp, organic, light-emitting diode display and facial recognition technology. Apple set the price at $1,000 in the hopes of boosting revenue. But troubles began when the new technology led to delays in the manufacturing process and forced Apple to abandon the use of fingerprints as an option to unlock the phones. Those early delays were made worse by a shortage of certain components used in the facial recognition system. Sales of the iPhone X was pushed back until November the 3rd, shortening the critical retailing window ahead of the holiday shopping season. Then, of course, there is that $1,000 base price. Many consumers don't believe the features justify the spending of that much money. Hey, consumers are not stupid. People do love Apple, but they still have limitations. So instead of the iPhone X, some customers have turned to older, cheaper models such as the iPhone 7 and 7 Plus. Well, this is not necessarily a bad thing for Apple. The older models are cheaper to produce and it generated a relatively higher margin of profit per unit. In an opinion piece recently published in the New York Times, they had an article about Apple cooperating with the Chinese government. Apple is selling out, as they say. It's not about the latest version of the iPhone, but the huge cache of personal data that would be going directly to the communist government of China. Given the Chinese government's continuing crackdown on human rights and freedom of speech, Apple's policies in China have far-reaching implications for every one of us. Last summer, Apple announced that it would be partnering with a state-owned company with the Communist Party connection to build Apple's first data storage center in China. Beginning by the end of February, the iCloud content of Apple ID users registered in China will be sent to and managed by this company. Customers registered in China, according to Apple's new terms and conditions agreement for the country, must understand and agree that Apple and the Chinese government will have access to all data that you store on this service, including the right to share, exchange, and disclose all user data, including content to and between each other under applicable law. Well, the short of it is that all personal user information stored on the iCloud, including photos, videos, text files, contacts, calendars, and iCloud email, could be available to the Chinese government as well. Apple has said that the Chinese government will not have access to the personal data stored in its facility without Apple's permission. But the new terms and conditions recently published appears to say otherwise. Under the agreement, Apple seems to be absolving itself of all responsibility for what the authority may choose to do with the personal information. Users who refuse Apple's term will be denied iCloud services. Users who accept run the risk of unwittingly provoking the ire of the government, the police state, resulting in deleted data or accounts, or, worse yet, harassment and imprisonment. This kind of partnership is at odds with the image Apple has built as a company committed to privacy and a willingness to stand up to pressure from larger entities like the United States government. Unfortunately, it now seems that such values are, well, taking a backseat to profits. In 2017, Apple also announced it was halting the sale of virtual private networks apps that allow users inside China to get access to blocked content that is critical for activists and regular citizens. iPhones in China also no longer include some Western news outlets, like, believe it or not, the New York Times, on the news app. It appears the shine on the Apple with all its ideals are no longer in polished mode. To be fair, however, many American tech companies have been tripping over themselves to get into China, and Facebook is one of them who has reportedly been developing censorship software so it can win approval to operate in China, while the company's chief executive, Mark Zuckerberg, has long been courting the Chinese leadership. For such companies, the Chinese market is simply too big of a temptation when weighed against less, much smaller measurable things like human rights and freedom of expression. For many decades, we've been talking about a paperless society. Well, it's not something where it's going to be absolutely paperless, but it's happening. Xerox has been under pressure to find new sources of growth as it struggles to reinvent itself with their business of office printing, and Fujifilm is also trying to streamline its copier business with a much larger focus on document solution services. What's happened is that the Japan Fujifilm will take over Xerox business in a joint venture valued at $6.1 billion. The combined company will keep the Fuji Xerox name and become a subsidiary of Fujifilm with dual headquarters in the United States and Japan, and it will be led by Xerox CEO Jacobson, while Fujifilm CEO Komori will serve as chairman. The joint venture accounts for nearly half of Fujifilm sales and operating profit. Both companies have struggled with slow business revenues as businesses increasingly go paperless. As part of its own restructuring, Fujifilm said that it will be cutting back 10,000 jobs in Japan, more than a fifth of its workforce at the joint venture. You know, there was a TV series many years ago, a number of decades ago, it was called Lost in Space. And what it's about is that there was a spaceship that, well, somehow got lost. Well, this is somewhat prophetic because NASA has made contact with a satellite lost in space 13 years ago, proving that things can turn up when you least expect them. NASA has just rediscovered a satellite that it lost in space more than a decade ago. The satellite was launched in 2000 to create the first comprehensive images of atmospheric plasma. It completed its initial mission in 2002. But right after that, it failed to make contact again on a routine pass by the Earth in 2005. Scientists hoped that it might be able to get back into a reboot stage in 2007. It never happened. So when it didn't, the mission was declared over and the satellite was expected to spend the rest of its days floating peacefully through the universe. Well, it has taken NASA a couple weeks to confirm that a mysterious satellite was indeed the satellite that's been missing, because of the hardware and operating system used in a satellite no longer exists. That's how they were able to identify the satellite that was lost. Other systems have been updated, several versions beyond what they were at the time, and now it requires a significant amount of reverse engineering to find out what that satellite has been collecting. After some tinkering, the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab in Maryland successfully collected telemetry data from the satellite, confirming its ID. Now, the team will spend the coming weeks analyzing data from the satellite to learn more about the state of the spacecraft and perhaps a little more about what has been up to all these years. It just goes to prove that in the field of electronics, and I know that many people have said to me, the system went dead and they just put it aside and it came back to life. You know what? Battery is one of the most inconsistent components that we have in the electronics business of computing. By the way, have you been thinking about increasing memory in your system? And you've been waiting for prices to go down? Well, it hasn't. And RAM prices, when you look at it from a two-year time frame, actually has gone up significantly, a little bit at a time. You just say, well, it's going to come back down. It hasn't. The slow increase in RAM prices hasn't gotten the same attention as a headline-grabbing sticker shock of perhaps other PC component prices. When a new RAM standard is introduced, and in this case we're talking about DDR4, it is often far more expensive than the mainstream standard it's supposed to replace, which was DDR3. Meanwhile, the new memory offers few to no benefits over the original, other than perhaps it will clock a little faster. Over time, the clock speed gap grows and costs on the new memory falls. Eventually, the two standards hit parity and the older RAM starts to become more scarce. Ultimately, the new RAM typically bottoms out cheaper than the old memory, and that's the way it's always been in the past 20, 30 years. But not this time. Over the past 2 years, the price of DRAM, or dynamic memory, has skyrocketed. The price of DDR4 has risen dramatically at every price point and capacity level. Sometimes you can avoid this kind of problem by picking slower or smaller capacity. But that's not the case here. Back in June 2016, you could buy 16 gigabyte of DDR4 memory for $70. Today, that same RAM memory is over $200. What's the explanation for this spiking is that there's been multiple demand for DDR4 and it's stripped the market bare of that memory. Memory capacity growth is expected to be a near historic low at 19.6% in 2018. Samsung, Hynix, and Micron are all cutting back on capital investments. DRAM wafers start at all three companies are only expected to grow by 5 to 7% this year. They're not putting any more money in to increase the capacity. They've learned that if you can control the capacity and make it available on demand, you're going to have a higher profit. And those of you thinking that, well, you know what, I'll buy DDR3 memory. Well, you aren't going to be happy at all, as DDR3 prices have also risen almost as much as DDR4. While still cheaper than DDR4, I don't recommend that you fall back on the older RAM standard, because eventually you're going to be using DDR4 as the old RAM standard. Smartphones have destroyed more than a generation is an opinion piece published in an issue of The Atlantic. On reflecting on this article, it's not a laughing matter. What's happening to our children, or in my case, grandchildren, in the age of the smartphone is really, frankly, scary and alarming. The article argues that the rise of smartphones and social media has destroyed a generation of young Americans by holding them captive to their devices day and night. The article refers to the generation born between 1995 and 2012, precisely when the saturation of smartphones reached 50% among Americans. This group of youth are referred to as iGen, as the follow-on designation to the millennial generation. iGen is the first generation to spend their entire adolescence in the age of the smartphone, with social media and texting replacing other activities. iGen spends less time with their friends in person and perhaps why they are experiencing unprecedented levels of anxiety, depression, and loneliness. But technology is not the only thing that makes iGens distinct from every generation before them. They are also different in how they spend their time, how they behave, and they socialize in completely new ways. They want different things from their lives and careers. More than previous generations, they are obsessed with safety, focus on tolerance, and have no patience for inequality. As this new group of young people grow into adulthood, we all need to understand them. Friends and family need to look out for them. Businesses must figure out how to recruit them and sell to them. Colleges and universities must know how to educate them and guide them. And members of iGen also need to understand themselves as they communicate with their elders and explain their views to their older peers. The portrait of today's teens is that they would rather spend time with their phones than their friends or their families. And they sleep with their devices on their pillows, who sit alone in their rooms, eyes glued to the screens. It's argued that the rise of the smartphone is related to decline in dating, going out, and driving among young Americans. It's also linked to more teenagers feeling depressed or having sleep problems. There is concern about screen time and that we don't fully understand the extent of it. Look at this way from a broader perspective. We are all affected by our overuse of our smartphones and devices. Something needs to be done to balance the way in which technology permeates our daily lives. Windows 10 captures a great deal of data as you use your PC, so you'll want to check out the additional controls Microsoft is building into future updates. As Windows 10 continues to collect data, Microsoft has also pledged to allow you to delete specific items that it captures, potentially cutting back on ads relating to perhaps an embarrassing search of an item. There's the option to delete individual pieces of data item by item. Currently, you can delete your entire search history, but not individual items. The next big update to Windows 10 is due around March or April, and it will support a new app, the Windows Diagnostic Data Viewer, that will allow Windows users to browse and inspect the data that the system has collected. Microsoft announced that the next major Windows 10 update has two settings for its data collection, basic and full. The new app will show users precisely what the full settings entails and a comparison of what would be sent with the basic setting. The new tool is a step forward in openness, but arguably it's not really addressing any of the data collection complaints that Windows 10 has generated. Microsoft feels it has nothing to hide and that there's nothing untoward about the collection of the data, but the company continues to maintain that this collection serves as an essential role for detecting, diagnosing, and addressing bugs and incompatibilities across the enormous diversity of Windows ecosystem itself. The two enhancements being tested with Microsoft 10 is the Windows Diagnostic Data Viewer and updates to the existing privacy dashboard, and it's designed to give users some feeling of control. Well, what does it mean to you? Well, it will allow Microsoft to show you ads in Edge, and you know that's an example of it, and to show you how your search determines what ads Windows displays. Well, I'm kind of curious about that, but I'm not really enthused about them doing it. We'll all probably experience situations where we've researched an item, purchased it, and then our browser continues to pop up ads for it. There's also the more embarrassing scenario of researching a potentially distressing medical condition, and your browser constantly nags you, reminding you of devices and ads relating to that query, and it really is invasion of your privacy. Granted that Microsoft has yet to demonstrate what the new controls will look like, but these are the two new aspects of the privacy dashboard that you should find, well, from their point of view, encouraging. More importantly, Microsoft is placing product and service activity on its new activity history page, demonstrating which apps or services have been triggered, and when Microsoft also plans to capture information about movies that you see, videos, the encoding type that you're using, the encryption that you're using, the music and TV, including purchase tracks in a person's collection. Hey, that's very personal.
Currently, Microsoft buries this at the bottom of an existing privacy dashboard, summarizing entirely irrelevant data such as what I just mentioned. Hopefully, Microsoft will allow users to see which apps, if any, access your search history, like with your microphone and other controls, as well as drill down into what apps and services and devices were accessed, and what Microsoft cross-checks with other apps reportedly accessed with your memory. And what we want to know is what Windows is cross-checking with other applications. The diagnostic data view is, according to those who have beta testing it, is very geeky looking. Microsoft is also adding an app to show exactly what data is collecting, dubbed the Windows Diagnostic Data Viewer. It'll be available to everyone within the Windows Store. The data really won't mean much to those without a working knowledge of the code and the hardware properties of their device. The Windows Diagnostic Data View provides Microsoft with a ton of fine-grained data. Microsoft says the data that the app will display will include common operating system data and information like preferences and settings, products and services, performance data such as health and reliability, software inventory data such as installed apps, and so on and so on and so on. That I'm concerned with. Consumer concerns with privacy in Windows 10 aren't going to go away anytime soon. What Microsoft will implement over the coming months is more fine-grained control over what data what you will allow Microsoft to store. I just hope there's a master option that we could say, capture no data. No chance that'll happen.
Our feature segments this evening is quite interesting. For Wearable and Health Technologies by Dr. Alfred Poor, he will discuss telehealth proofs to save money. He will talk about artificial intelligence helps an amputee play jazz piano. And he'll talk about implantable sensor dissolves in 4 days. From the tech corner, I'm going to touch on the issue on the FBI lost text messages. Come on, give me a break. You're the FBI and you have backup. And finally, for home automation with Marty Winston, concerns for environmental controls.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
The doctor will see you now. If you're like me, that conjures up images of long waits in a doctor's waiting room surrounded by sick people, not getting work done and wishing you were someplace else. Well, telehealth is coming to save the day. We may not be able to get doctors to make house calls like they used to, but they can now by video chat and other telecommunications features. While we all know that this would be more convenient than the go to the doctor's office routine that we have now, the question is, yeah, but is it as good? Does it really help? And the good news is lots and lots and lots of studies are showing that telehealth can actually do as well or better than the traditional model. One study recently was conducted in Spain. They did in-home telemonitoring of patients with chronic diseases. In particular, it was with heart failure or chronic lung disease. These are diseases that frequently result in readmission to the hospital and lengthy stays and all kinds of complications. Well, they had two groups. One was treated normally and one was able to submit information about their health through a smartphone app and using connected devices that they had in their home. At the end of 12 months, they discovered that the hospital admissions for the control group, the ones that weren't treated, had an average of 2.6 hospital readmissions per patient. But the telehealth group, it was only 1.1, less than half the number of admissions. Emergency room visits were cut in half from 4.2 per patient to 2.1. And the average length of stay for patients that were admitted to the hospital, that was cut by more than 3 days, from about 11 days down to 8 days. And so this is a huge gain, not only in the quality of life for the patients, but it also saves a ton of healthcare money. So better outcomes, lower costs. Telehealth is on the way, and we can hope for a future where we're going to have more interactions with the doctor, with less travel, and more efficient use of everybody's time. If you read technology stories these days, it seems that everyone is filled with blockchains or artificial intelligence or machine learning or some new high-tech kind of technology that's changing the world. Well, some of this stuff is actually being used for pretty old-fashioned kinds of things. There's a young man who played jazz piano. Unfortunately, he had an injury where he lost one of his hands. Researchers down at the Georgia Institute of Technology actually created a mechanical hand, a prosthetic hand, but it uses artificial intelligence to allow him to control it. Basically, what was happening was they took readings of the muscle signals that he was sending to his forearm and used an artificial intelligence machine learning program to decipher what those different signals meant as he was trying to do things. So he thought about moving his index finger, and they read the signals, and he tried to move his middle finger, and they read the signals. And so they were able to create a program that would translate those impulses to control the individual fingers of this mechanical prosthetic hand. He actually is now able to play the piano with his one good hand and his prosthetic hand. So this is a real step forward for helping amputees live a more normal life and give them more control and be able to interact better with their environment. But more than that, it shows how this artificial intelligence tools that we have are able to take information that seems almost random and pull the information out of it in order to do very useful things with it. Not all sensors are worn on the outside of our bodies. There's a lot of reasons why we would want to have sensors that are implanted in our bodies to measure pressure or temperature or other kinds of things from inside. But the problem is many of the sensors that we have are made out of materials that are not readily accepted by the body. And sometimes they can be rejected. They can cause infection or inflammation or other kinds of problems. And then there's also the problem when you're done with it, you no longer need the sensor and its information. Typically, it requires an invasive surgical procedure to go back in and get it. Well, researchers at the University of Connecticut have developed a pressure sensor that can be used for a wide variety of applications that is designed to be implanted in the body. But the neat thing about it is not only is it made out of biocompatible materials, things that won't irritate the body, it's actually made of biodegradable materials. All the components of the sensor can dissolve into the body and leave no ill effects. These are all materials that have already been approved by the FDA for things like sutures and other kinds of implants. They were able to implant it, and it produced signals for 4 days, and then it dissolved into its organic components and disappeared. So this gives researchers and doctors a whole new tool to work with so that they can find out more what's going on inside an individual's body and not have to perform surgery to go in and get it when they're done.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. My two cents on the FBI missing texts. The FBI was purported to have lost thousands of text messages. The FBI reportedly blamed it all on a technical glitch for the missing texts. Well, in the last week, virtually all the text messages have been recovered almost overnight, although the headlines did not reference any mention of backup. It is that which made it possible for recovery. What I found most puzzling was that the initial comment from the FBI said that it was due to a technical glitch, and there was no mention that the FBI does backup of all information. This came as to me a surprise. The FBI is supposed to be high-tech and on the leading edge of scientific tools. To have initially said the messages were lost, they did themselves a great disservice. Without getting into the politics of it, let's look at it from a technical perspective. Backup procedures for all government agencies and large corporations are quite extensive. I only wish that personal computing level people take backup seriously. I know I sound like a nag at the end of each show with backup, backup, and backup. In the business environment, backups are performed religiously each business day. The information is retained for a specific period of time to meet regulatory requirements. For many companies, the end-of-week backups are sent to another physical site in case of a major disruption. This was the case with 9/11, in which financial institutions were able to get back into operation within a few days. For the average computer user, the only absolute data considered critical that needs to be regularly backed up are legal, health, and academic work that is necessary for a degree. The hard truth is that your digital photographic collection, music library, and collection of video clippings are important only to you. But when the time comes when you pass through to another world, I hate to say this, but the material will probably be tossed. If these materials were backed up whenever there is new material, it'd be nice, but it would only be the end of the world only to you if the data was lost. The personal computer show is informational and educational, and we purposely do not try to inject editorial comments in other areas. But as it relates to backup, I should not take it for granted that everyone knows what is involved with backup. To ensure full integrity of backup for recovery and restoration, the process is more time-consuming than it is complex. But if you don't do any backup and the computer is just for browsing, okay, that's fine. Backup's not necessary. But if you just back up on a regular basis onto the same external media and not keep retention of any data, in other words, you just write over itself, is this the ideal way to back up? No, but it's the least you could do. For most people, the critical personal data can easily fit onto a USB flash drive. If you don't know what to back up, just copy your user subdirectory onto the flash drive. If you do use a USB flash drive for external media, I suggest you download and run the program Speedout version 0.5. Do you know how fast the read and write speed of that USB flash drive you're using? Unfortunately, there are no speed markings on any USB flash drive you buy. This is a portable app program that will identify the read speed and the write speed of the drive. Try to use a USB flash drive with a high write speed. This will speed up your backup. The speed of read is only a factor when you need to use it for data recovery, which is, hopefully, well, never or rare. Consider using one different USB flash drive for each day of the week. If you do maintain retention cycle of data on a regular basis, give yourself a grade C. Let's say you also have selected data to be retained at a separate physical site. Give yourself a grade of B. Well, you may ask, what then qualifies for a grade of A? Well, if you back up regularly, maintain retention cycle of saves, and you arrange to have a separate physical storage of data, what's missing? If you have made arrangements for use of equipment in case of loss of hardware, or you have another system readily available, then you have thought through what backup entails. Let's say you're writing your doctorate thesis or you're filling your tax return on the evening of the deadline date. You need to also make sure that there's a viable alternative to continue processing in case of your system fails. Let's say you're using a cloud backup service, Google, Amazon, and there are other big-time service centers or cloud centers, and they're available and they're very modest in cost. Well, I got news for you. It's just the nature of operating hardware and communication system. They do go down. The process of backup includes, get this now, the process of backup includes recovery, reinstallation, and alternative processing when needed. If you're running a small business or doing independent consulting work, you need to have a grade A backup plan. I can tell you based on experience, most people think the loss of data only happens to other people. However, when fate has designated you as the lucky one to lose critical data, I then have a converted listener. This is like a smoker who thinks that they will not be inflicted with cancer until it happens. Unfortunately, there are those who have lost important data and figure lightning won't strike twice with the same person. It can and it has happened. In the past, loss of data was primarily caused by hardware and software issues. Now throw onto the mix of things that can cause a problem that requires recovery is when you got these hackers hitting you with social engineering and ransomware. Let's say you did all the right things and there was no mischief with your system and your system crashed. Well, I'll accept the fact that it might have been God's will, but that still does not excuse you from not backing up your system on a regular basis. So get to it. Back up your system. In the typical enterprise computing operating environment, there are concerns for control of humidity and air conditioning. The typical small business and homeowner of personal computers don't really give this subject much thought. I've asked Marty his thoughts on this subject, and he talks about its impact on being energy miserly and maintenance free.
Sometimes when we're chasing down ways to improve the energy miserliness of our 40-year house, we go in strange and unexpected directions and discover things that other people aren't noticing. And sometimes I really think it's important to share this with you. So bear with me as we go into humidity, of all things, humidity. And I want to bring you some strange information about it and a strange conception of it. But here's why. Humidity, adding it or taking it out, is costing you more than it needs to. So at your house, do you have a humidifier or do you have a dehumidifier? I might add, if you have an air conditioner, being a dehumidifier is a big part of what it does. And for that matter, is your house itself acting as a humidifier or dehumidifier? It can. I'll get into that. And why should you care? Well, money. That's why you should care. I always seem to have reasons for caring, don't I? And one of the big reasons, the point where this is leading, but not really a spoiler, is a sudden realization that these things, humidification, dehumidification, may end up picking your pocket when you pay the power bill and again when it's time to repair or replace the humidifier, dehumidifier, whatever you have. Now, do I have a little more of your interest? Talking about relative humidity means talking about water that's not really a liquid because it's suspended in air. And it's really hard for anyone to be able to tell very moist air from very dry air except at the extremes of moist or dry. If you can't move around without sweating, boy, that's moist. If everything you touch is static sparks, that's dry. Those things you can feel, you can sense. So let's shift our thinking a little. I want to help you understand the more variable levels of relative humidity by not thinking of it as moistness. I want you to imagine that humidity has an aroma, a terrible, stinky, smelly, obnoxious aroma. At low levels, it's just a sense of, oh, hey, something here doesn't smell so good. At high levels, it's, help, I can barely breathe. This is disgusting. Now, imagine that your house is absolutely free and clear of this stinky, but it was really intense right outside the walls. At your house, do you think you'd be able to smell it through the windows or doors or walls or ceilings or floors? Did you ever have a skunk in the yard? Have you been able to smell it? How did that smell get in? Okay, well, then flip it around. What if there was no stink outside, but your house smelled to high heaven? Do you think the stink might leak out through everything and make the space around your house smelly? It's not easy to imagine the vapor level of water in air seeping through, but the idea of stink is visceral and real. Let me add one more concern before we clear the air. What if I were to tell you that the walls inside your house could soak in the stink and later still be passing the stink back into the room long after the reason for it was gone? Okay, abracadabra, let's turn the relative stinkiness level back into relative humidity. Breathing easier now, that's temporary. You've seen houses being built, 2x4 framing, cladding tacked on from the outside, fluffy insulation rolls in the walls, and wallboard nailed onto the frame inside. Every element of that can let humidity pass through the walls, and the drywall gypsum wallboard can absorb and release moisture. Your floors and your ceilings are no better. Your home may involve 100 big or little measures to insulate against temperature changes. And yes, those measures really can save energy. but humidity has remained somewhere between ignored and invisible. Well, nothing has to be visible here. This is radio, so we can help your mind's eye do the visualizing. What if you wanted to stop those humidity leaks? What would you do? Blowing high-density foam into the walls and ceiling and floor spaces can cut way down on how much humid air can cross the walls, the ceilings, the floors, how much can cross the building envelope. By the way, it also greatly improves your thermal insulation. Double bonus. Those wall boards that act like humidity sponges stop doing that when you seal them off by using the right kind of paint on them. Go to the paint store. Tell the guy you don't want to let any vapors through. So why do you want to do that? Well, say it's really dry outside and your humidifier is running. If the house is well sealed against humidity loss, once the humidifier gets to that level where it needs to be, it stays there largely on its own for a reasonably long time. But if it's not sealed, oh, here you go. Humidity leaks to the outside through the walls and other parts of the building envelope, and it's like trying to bail out a rowboat with a hole in the bottom. You have to keep working hard long after the work should have been over and done. In this case, it's your humidifier. It doesn't turn off. It keeps running. It has to come back on sooner. And because it's running more hours, it's getting old faster, and it will be that much earlier that you have to replace it. When it's your humidifier that's working that much higher, its energy consumption goes up, the meter spins a little faster for a little longer, and your energy bill climbs. That humidifier will also wear out at a younger age because it will take less time to use up its specified hours of life expectancy, and you'll have a replacement or repair bill to pay. Now, if it's humid outside, the same thing. Your dehumidifier or air conditioner could get done sooner with less energy usage and less wear and tear if your house is sealed against humidity losses. Believe it or not, this whole thing is a new perspective on home construction. It's not popular. It's not well understood. It isn't published as far as I can find out. The guys at the building supply stores and the contractors haven't thought about it. Or, for that matter, they haven't been briefed about it. But as you already know, it's a little science and a lot of common sense. Now, I'm in the early days chasing down solutions for this. When I learn more, I'll share it here. But for now, keep this in mind. Anytime you're trying to make some change happen, and that change is not contained, it's allowed to leak, no matter how you consider that being leaking, it's energy or it's an effect that is diminished by not being contained. Anytime that happens, you have a loss that shows up in this case in energy usage, in money for your utility bills, and in the repair costs you're going to have to bring back when your humidifier or dehumidifier, or for that matter, the air conditioner, can no longer maintain the levels because something's broken down. It reaches end of life. My dad used to say about the channel changer on the TV set, don't keep spanning those channels. That thing's only got so many clicks in it. Well, he was wrong, because no human can make it click that much. But it's the same principle. There's only so much in it. Think about it again. I'm going to go through this just one more time. If you're trying to reach a humidity level with a humidifier and the house doesn't contain the change, if it's lossy, if it's leaky, you're going to be running it longer. It's going to cost you more money. It's going to need replacement sooner. Same with dehumidifying. If it's too wet in the house, if you need to pull that water out of the air and the humid air from outside leaks into the house, you've got the same challenge. You're still working longer, more expensively, and harder than you have to. It's stopping loss that creates energy miserliness. Yes, efficiency helps, but stopping loss stops the bigger damage. Well, one thing for sure, rethinking humidity is worth a little sweat. Hank?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the Northeast Regional Tri-State Area. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Bitcoin, Thursday, February the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, February the 2nd, 8 p.m., at Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bardo Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, February the 6th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center of Ewing will have a presentation on, my favorite topic, backing up your computer, Tuesday, February the 6th, 1:30 p.m., 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, February the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be having their meeting Friday, February the 9th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, Auditorium of Harry J. Scherer Hall. The Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, February the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. These meetings are all open to the public, free to attend, and we're looking forward to seeing you there.
The Trenton Computer Festival is the longest continuously running personal computer show in the world, and it is a one-day festival with talks, presentations, and flea market. It originated back in 1976. This year's festival will be held March the 17th, 2018, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the College of New Jersey. For more information, the website is tcf-nj.org.
The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, you need to back up. Make sure you back up your files. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and till we meet again, same time, same station next week.